702 podcasts are on 702.co.za.
It's 11 minutes after 10 o'clock. Karabo Mokonyana is my guest, award-winning legal and development practitioner, but also a columnist for the Mail and Guardian. Recently wrote an opinion piece entitled "Why Are South African Leaders Corrupt?" And she joins me now on the line. Karabo, thank you so much for joining me. Much appreciated. A very provocative title there. Why are South African leaders corrupt? I mean, is that the conclusion, that they are corrupt?
Good evening, Owen. Good evening to your listeners. I wouldn't say my conclusion. I think there's quite a lot publicly that confirms the conclusion.
Yeah.
From the outcomes of, you know, the Zondo Commission, to a lot of the stories that we are seeing. I mean, even the government themselves have acknowledged that South Africa is struggling when it comes to corrupt activities, whether it's in the public sector, whether it's, you know, business leaders, civil society. We just really have that problem within our country.
There have been conversations about this through recent times, and in many occasions the conversation has really gone to a place that says, but how can you say leaders are corrupt? Some leaders are corrupt. You seem to be making a very generalized statement here to say leaders. And which leaders? Political leaders, business leaders, or all of the above?
No, so I am looking into, I think it's less me generalizing, but I didn't want to really like pinpoint people. And to clarify, definitely, I'm not saying all leaders are corrupt. I am speaking to the specific leaders who've either been implicated, who basically have been, let's just say, found to be guilty of corruption charges. If there's been such in our country.
Like,
so I'm speaking to those specific leaders. And I think I hone in heavily to individuals who are corrupt. Because in South Africa, we heavily like to speak about corruption as if it's just an institutional thing.
Mm.
And I think it's important for us now to break down the individual who is behind the corruption and why it is that they even get to a point of making such decisions. Why is it that they feel like it's okay for me to either misappropriate funds or to make these sort of decisions? And, you know, and that can't always be blamed on institutions.
Yeah, yeah. Dikeledi Waka Malebio on Twitter raises, and I think it's part of the conversation we are going to have, raises the question that says, why are we generally a corrupt society, right? Now, you've just said that perhaps we need to focus on the individuals and not just the institutions. Is it fair to bring in society, the society in which these individuals grow up, are reared, are taught certain values? Is there room for society to take some liability in how these individuals that we're going to talk about turn out?
Absolutely. I think it becomes societal norms and things that we have regarded as acceptable. So it obviously starts with individuals, but as we see more individuals get on the bandwagon, then it becomes a societal norm that we have regarded as okay and nothing surprising.
Let's look at the individuals.
Yes.
And perhaps you could help me first by understanding, what do we mean by corruption? It's one of those words we use quite easily, especially when we are gutful, to use a beautiful South African word, right? When we're angry, when we feel vulnerable, when we feel insecure, when we feel cheated, when we feel robbed, we speak of corruption, right? But what is this thing? What is corruption?
Okay. So corruption has to do mainly, and I'm going to simplify it because it can go into all sorts of things, but really it has to do with a person being dishonest, firstly. So we're going to take it to dishonesty. And dishonesty in a capacity that requires you, you're in a capacity where you have authority, you're in a position of power, and you decide then to use that power and your access dishonestly by actually acquiring personal benefits or using it for personal benefit, whether it's to benefit yourself, firstly directly, or those, you know, your loved ones or whoever. So it is basically for personal benefit, and you use your power in a dishonest manner in which you either require, you're rather required to use that power for public benefit, but then use it mainly for personal benefit.
Tell me why we have these people, and how do they arise? How do they emerge? How do they get to those places where they've got the authority to ultimately fit the description you've just given?
Phew, I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all box. I think, and in the piece, I really break it down. I think there are various reasons as to why. But I particularly started with one that we really don't speak about, that we really speak about in South Africa. And this one is very contextual to South Africa. And it relates to the economic trauma that a lot of the people who we see in power have had to go through as a result of apartheid post-traumatic disorder. So there is so much economic trauma in a sense that they've never had access to a lot of the things that they've been exposed to. So a lot of the time, there is then this aspect of, I have access, I need to retain it because I've never had that. At the same time, then, because of the how South Africa's economy just performed, there's so much insecurity. A lot of people feel economically insecure in this country. And once you then have access to the, you know, the funds and a lot of the power and access to resources that can help you mitigate that economic insecurity, then a lot of the times they can't help but utilize that power that they actually have. And this is something that absolutely stems from just the economy, the state of the economy, but also then the economic trauma that came, the social, political, and economic trauma that came as a result of apartheid. So that's one of them.
But let's talk a little bit about that, Karabo.
Okay.
Because some of the most exemplary leaders, right, in terms of moral fortitude, in terms of servant leadership, came out of that very milieu that you've just described now. They were the people that were traumatized to immeasurable levels by the apartheid system, one. Two, these were people that may have even been imprisoned, maimed, family members killed. But out of that space, out of that reality, out of that socioeconomic reality, came out some of the most exemplary leaders the world has ever seen at any given age, right?
Absolutely.
Is it fair to blame those socioeconomic realities for the lack of moral rectitude of an individual, when there is such glaring examples of people that experienced similar, maybe even worse situations, but who emerged and towered over most of us, morally speaking?
I would say that, you know, I think for a lot of the people who are able to then, you know, not allow such circumstances to dictate them to getting into corruption, you needed some form of moral compass backing or value system, you know, accompanied with all of that. Because, you know, you and I could experience the same thing, but for you, there's a value system that still requires you to, you know, to make sure that, your value systems, but your moral compass, how you actually regulate your own life also dictates how you behave going forward. Whereas for me, that might not be the case. my moral compass, my value system has been put myself first, put food on the table, and that's that. But you could have experienced the exact same past traumas. So I think it's definitely fair to say that there are people who experience the same thing, but at the same time, in terms of what then for us going forward, our moral systems, our value systems are not necessarily the same. And that's why then you get very different outcomes in terms of how leaders who come from the same circumstance behave entirely different, especially when they're exposed to power.
Is it fair then to then look at those socioeconomic indicators that you've just spoken of as a reason for the existence of corruption, if indeed, as you point out, there are people who have a correct moral compass?
I'd say it's a motive. It's a valid motive to be like, the reason why I am going to take public funds
yeah.
because of these things. So it's a valid
It's my turn to eat.
It's my turn to eat. Particularly in relation to I've fought hard to get this democracy, it's my turn to eat.
But what that means, what that does is that it legitimizes that very same apartheid, doesn't it? You know what I mean? In a very sort of strange, ironic way, it legitimizes the very thing that you fought against because you're using it to justify your criminality. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. That's true.
So is the dissonance, the cognitive dissonance so large, so deeply pathological that the people who would use that background as a legitimization process to legitimize and to rationalize their criminality and corruption, is there nothing in that whole matrix that says, hey, wait a second, do you see what you're doing here?
I mean, they're doing it, so I'm guessing, you know, they probably don't see what is wrong with it, because I think there are many things that could really deter a lot of the corrupt leaders, you know, within our country, particularly if you're in the public sector. You are meant to be serving, you know, citizens, and in a country where particularly there's so much economic inequality, I'd like to think that, you know, that should be enough reason. But somebody who's been in that position doesn't regard that as a valid reason. For them, it's more of a, you know, it's a self thing. Am I in a better economic position? Does this provide security for me? So it's more self-serving, and it's less really about benefiting the public and serving the public. So a lot of it, move away from public service, but rather it's an opposite. I'm in power, and how I utilize that power is then going to be to my benefit. But at the same time, then just in terms of that, then you could speak to their character to say, when a person has power, how do they treat people who don't have power? And that's one of the things that I think our leaders just lack. When you get that power, how do you treat people who don't have the power?
Give me a call if you've had occasion to think about why are South African leaders corrupt. That is, by the way, the title to Karabo's opinion piece in the Mail and Guardian. Have you had time to think about it objectively and perhaps dispassionately and say, oh, so these may be the variables, the reasons why we have a proliferation of criminality and corruption, particularly at leadership level? And she points specifically to the people that are in positions of state power specifically, suggesting that because of apartheid and because of the socio-economic, psychological perhaps traumas that they experienced, they somehow reason and rationalize to themselves that it is now time for their comfort by any means necessary. In fact, if I understand you correctly, Karabo, it almost seems as if you're suggesting that they even see it as an act of political revolutionarism. Right? That it's almost part of their political duty almost to take, as it were.
I wouldn't take it that far. But I think maybe they'd rather economically liberate themselves from the position that they were once in.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. But I mean, other things do come in, you know, I think the greed aspect is always the one that the popular one amongst South Africans when we have conversations. But at the same time, I think another one is around, I think, because they're good leaders, you know, they're ethical leaders that come into the system. But I think we also then need to be honest about ethical leaders who get into any sort of system and they find it to be, for lack of a better word, rotten. They then just faced with a lot of the, if you can't beat them, join them narrative, because, I mean, if you are not aligning, they will get you out. How do you maintain ethical practices and trying to be as ethical in a space that, you know, has enabled corrupt activity? And if you even get to the spectrum of them being a whistleblower, your life is in danger. So, you know,
we've just had that conversation now, yeah.
Yeah, but also then going as far as, you know, I think the system, like, we don't really have a strong anti-corruption structure within our government. And I guess that's why we had to have the Zondo Commission. But even just with that, I think when you get into a space and you realize that, oh, there's room for me to steal here, then, I mean, people do it. But if you feel like, ooh, if I steal here, there's going to be too much repercussions, I think that's where we don't have that culture.
Yeah, so there's no consequence management. There are no accountability structures that are going to get you if you do something wrong. I hear that. I want, while we are on the apartheid conversation, talk about, and I don't know whether you touched on this in your article, but I do want to find out about the fact that the apartheid state was essentially a corrupt state, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a state that basically created laws that excluded people from economic, from social, from geographical inclusion on the basis of the color of their skin, right? And out of that whole process, people benefited in many different ways. People were affirmed as far as economic things were concerned, education was concerned. People were given a leg up, as it were, by this fundamentally corrupt situation, right? The system, in as much as you point to the fact that it produced an individual who rewards themselves on the back of the hurt that they had during apartheid, who usually would be in the space of state power. What about the person who grows up believing that I've got all that I have because I am a hardworking individual, because I am not corrupt, because I am actually good, but doesn't see the fact that, in fact, they are where they are precisely because of the system and the levers of the system, which was corrupt, that got them there? Is that person corrupt?
I would say that person is a beneficiary of corruption. So they are a beneficiary of corruption. I would say that, you know, in terms of, I mean, also to the extent, were they involved in the initial thing? If they were not, and maybe, you know, just to say, the forefathers were involved, And as a result, they are now benefiting from that system. I would rather say than they are beneficiaries of a corrupt system.
But if I continue to be a beneficiary of corruption, in other words, if I benefit from ill-gotten gains, if somebody steals a car and I continue to use it as transport for taking my kids to school, you see where I'm going here?
Yeah, I do.
Am I corrupt?
I think that's an arguable one. You know, I think that's something we would have to put out there to, like, you know, is this corruption or not? And I think we'd come back with different answers. Some people would say it's absolutely corrupt because you benefited from corruption. Others would say you were not directly involved. You just happened to fall within, you know, the line of benefit and you benefited.
The reason why I asked that question is because part of the legitimization and the rationalization of the criminality and corruption of the other guy may come from that kind of argument, right? To say, but fine, you can say that I'm corrupt. I mean, I always think of Umsholozi, for example, who says, you can say whatever you can say anything about me, you can say whatever, it's fine, I'm not going to argue about that. But there are certain people here that have been beneficiaries and participants in corruption that want to look like they are skoon papier here. And that's why I'm going after some of those people. And it goes back to that question that was raised by DK Lady to say, are we not in the throes of a generally corrupt system that our society generally is caught up in corruption, that our advancements, our everything that we are about, whether we know it or not, has been created on a foundation of criminality and corruption, and therefore we cannot escape that if we are honest?
I say yes. You know, I think corruption is heavily entrenched within our society. I mean, from the little things, you know, traffic departments.
Cold drink.
Cold drink. It is definitely, like, it's so embedded within our system that sometimes you even get shocked when you don't have to take out cold drinks and something is done in the most ethical way. And unfortunately, because it's such an embedded system, we do need now to find ways to break that down. We really need that to break. We need ways to break it down. And ethical leaders are the only way. Those are the only people who can get in and be like, we need to change systems within specific institutions. And it's really possible. It's really possible. There are institutions, you know, within our country that I can say are really doing their best to make sure that things are running. I'm going to give examples. Treasury. Treasury is really doing well. I think Treasury is the one place where they can steal money from the get-go because that's where money, all the money is. But they've created such an, like, the internal system is so good that even the staff in themselves are dissuaded from thinking of actually stealing. It has its own politics, but I think SARS is also a close second. And they're functioning. They're really functioning. And maybe it's because they collect money and, you know, they will come to those people. But they actually are really good in terms of managing and the corruption aspect and, you know. And I think it is really possible with a lot of it. You really need to have ethical leaders who want it internally changed, but also then create systems. I think we don't explore technology enough in terms of its ability to create, to close the gaps and the loopholes that exist within our systems.
I want to take some calls, Garabo, because there's a lot of people who want to weigh in on the conversation already. I want to read you some of the stuff coming through on Twitter. But I'm being careful here to have a conversation that does not give corruption a color.
Mm-hmm.
because very easily it happens inadvertently. And it happens very easily, very, very subconsciously,
mm-hmm.
that we ultimately give corruption a color. And that color usually is a guy that looks like me.
Uh-huh.
So I'm quite sensitive of that, because corruption does not happen in isolation. It doesn't just happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are micro and meta reasons why these things happen, and that is not to pathologize. That is not to try and humanize it. That's not to try and make it normal and normalize it. Because I think here's a question coming from Mulan on Twitter. Says, I don't think I agree with your guest. I don't know if I heard her correctly. It sounds as if she says these corrupt leaders had no choice but to be corrupt. Nothing about being poor says you are entitled to behave badly because you are poor. And I don't think that's what you're saying, is it?
Corrupt? No.
Yeah?
It's not. Definitely. Poor people not having money, not having resources, does not entitle them. We are talking about motives and what gets people to that level and what reasons, and not to say the reasons that they find and are correct, but what goes through their minds when they actually say, okay, I'm going to steal, and this is why I'm going to steal, and how they then justify it, and exploring some of those reasons.
Let's take some calls. France in Dube. Mfundisi, good evening to you.
Hey, good day, sir.
I'm very, very good. Oh, it's not the Mfundisi. I thought it was the Mfundisi in Dube. Good evening to you, France. What is on your mind, my brother?
Thank you very much, Speaker, for giving me this opportunity to present my thought and comment regarding the conversation that we are having.
Go ahead, honorable member. Go ahead.
And now, as we can speak now, as you see that us as our community, I stay in Dubai, I am one of the people who, I'm one of the my community. So corruption comes to a point that we as young ones, I grow up going to school, but when I reach the age of finish line whereby I come across to a situation whereby there is a lack of job, there is only only option that can generate money from me, which is corruption, which will be told by our leaders top there, which is the ANC, the EFF, and the DA, by speaking to each other to a point whereby us, as we see them, we do not have any, we are self-conscious about what is regarding the South African promotion, and after the South African politician parties, corruption that is going process, our president, our leaders, and also those people who are also settling this house now, with the 350 that they are giving us to receive in our hands, so that we can keep and be shy to raise our voice as the voice of the voiceless.
Mm. France in Dube, thanks very much for your call. Much appreciated. Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. Corruption. Why are South Africa's leaders corrupt, asks Karabo, and answers it in many ways. Tsepo is in Pretoria. Hi, Tsepo.
Hi, Aubrey. Good evening, and good evening to the guest today.
Yeah.
Just a quick one on my side. I think one of the biggest reasons why we have failed from a leadership perspective is South Africa failed from the advent of 1994, failed to take lessons from the African countries. We always look down on African countries. We always think that we were better, and therefore we would never get to be like, you know, most of the African countries. But if you look at us right now, I mean, if you look at where Zimbabwe is, it is a reality in South Africa that we could head in that direction. I'm hoping that we don't go in that direction, but there is now sight of Zimbabwe in South Africa if we continue in the same trajectory of the kind of leaders that we appoint in the public sector. So I think that's really point number one, that we failed to learn from our African counterparts. That's the first point.
Yeah.
Now, the second point is I the idolization that is there of ministers. Ministers are appointed by the president, but the way they are idolized by the DGs, by the head of these institutions, it, to me, it just doesn't make sense. Because these people are just employees. They are just, they are deployed to head up those countries. So why must they be idolized so much? They are idolized to such a point that they influence who gets appointed in all of those departments. And by them having influence and who's getting appointed as a DG or as any positions in those specific state-owned entities, it gives them a hand into those departments. So I think that, for me, is a very, very a big problem. And then the third point is the political system in South Africa, where in South Africa you've got the, let me just make a simple example of the EFF, DA, and the ANC, right? There's no common objectives. There's nothing that we share common vision with. If the ANC, the EFF, and the DA could say, our common objective is to eradicate unemployment, and we all, like, let's argue about everything, but let's not argue about unemployment. Let's rather maybe debate on what is the best way of actually doing it. But let's not oppose each other when it comes to that. So the political system, the honest truth is, it's not going to take us anywhere, because there is nothing that our political parties are doing that is actually moving us in the right direction, because they're always, always just about themselves and opposing each other and trying to prove each other wrong. Last thing, ethical leadership. Ethical leadership is a possible solution, but not in the current state of the country, because ethical leaders, I mean, it's like the gentleman that we had before this hour, who said that, look, I mean, I don't have security in my house. So he wants to be ethical, but he doesn't have security in his house. You understand? So do you now then sacrifice yourself? And we've seen so many other people who've sacrificed themselves for what? So ethical leadership, yes, it's the answer to the question, but there's still a bigger question. Who protects ethical leadership? We know so many ethical leaders who have been hung by these political leaders, who never even stood up to say, but this person is actually saying the right thing. Let me actually stand by them. When an ethical leader stands up, instead of the president or whoever backing up that leader, no, that does not happen in South Africa or any of the other political parties. So for me, I think really, really, we need, the current political party needs to lose power in order for us to get a reset button and in order for us to actually restart. And I think the society will take the direction themselves. I don't think any political party will be able to formulate a direction that we need to take, or anyone will actually dictate what kind of direction we need to take. But I think it is following the fall of the current leading political party that a society will then dictate the direction that it actually needs to take. Thank you very much, Opie.
Tsepo in Pretoria. Karabo, what do you make of some of the things that have been said by our listeners? But I also want you to weigh in on the conversation around corporate leadership. Are they corrupt? And if so, why are they corrupt?
Okay, so just to weigh in on some of the comments, I think in terms of just African leadership, I would say the continent has a lot of corrupt leadership generally. Angola is a good example. You've got, like, the leadership on our continent needs a reset button entirely. But I really liked what was said around, you know, the glorifying of ministers. And I think that speaks to how we view the relationship between, let's say, public servants and us as citizens. I think we've lost the touch of viewing it as you are in this position to serve us as a public. We are the ones that have put you into that position because we trust you enough to be able to govern our society into a better place. And I think we as a country have definitely, maybe we are unaware of it, or we've just lost that because of the power dynamics. I mean, they get into power and they forget that people have put them into those roles and those positions. People have voted them into those positions of power. And yeah, the power really just gets to their head. In terms of corporate, absolutely. There is corruption in corporate, particularly relating to things like, for example, fronting. So there's a lot of BEE fronting where a lot of black people are used as spaces, but not necessarily included economically within the structures. There's also things like, you know, for the procurement processes as well. I mean, there's a lot of nepotism. There's a lot of, you know, giving your friend the tender, basically. So those are things that equally, you know, we regard as corruption within the corporate sector. But I think what makes the corporate sector a little bit more, like, it's not as visible, firstly because of the private nature of a lot of the transactions and the things that go on. There's not as much public scrutiny as with public sector. Your motive is to make money. Your motive is within, I mean, even the regulatory framework around the private sector is not as strong. The power dynamics between private sector and public sector, you can see that private sector has, a lot of the times in this country, they can kind of do what they want to do because they are the muscle. They are the financial muscle of this country in terms of job creation, in terms of the GDP contribution. And they do get to get away with a lot of this stuff because for this country to stand, the private sector and the corporate contributions are extremely important. But because of that, also there's not much public scrutiny. It's not as visible and it's not as scrutinized.
I watch how, in order for a corrupt activity to take place, there's got to be a corrupter and a corruptee. There's got to be somebody out there that has the means, and then, of course, somebody with the opportunity, right? And usually those that are corrupt in the public sector do so because they have an inspirer or somebody out there that is also looking for the benefits of that position but is not in the public sector. We've seen, as you pointed out with the Zondo Commission, how some of the so-called reputable auditing companies that were involved in the looting that took place, that maybe still takes place in organizations such as SARS, companies such as Bain & Co., right? Companies that McKinsey, all of these companies that have been involved, and many of them called consultants, have been the architects and the designers of the model of corruption. They design how it's going to work. In fact, in South Africa, we talk about state capture. We talk about the fact that there is an alternative state that was being created on the basis of premeditated, properly designed models for the hollowing out of the legitimate state, right? So I suppose what I'm trying to say is that it appears to me that one level of corruption is easy for us to see, as you've already pointed out, and the other is more clandestine. It's more covert. It's more harder to point at.
Absolutely, and I think that's why in the country you've seen then a lot of move towards privatization. It's very difficult for the public or just generally to scrutinize corruption that is happening within the private sector, within the corporations. And that's why it was, you know, with state capture, it went on for years. And whereas with something like if it's even regarded as corruption, like a palapala, it is very easy to like pick up because public and, you know, it's an official and that sort of thing. But had the palapala thing been within the context and led within the context of corporations and the private sector, and you then have a lot of the public leaders benefiting, but not being direct in terms of them facilitating the process, then it's harder to see. So definitely corruption in the private sector is very difficult to track. It's very difficult to scrutinize. And I think even just our, you know, the government in itself does not know how to regulate and tap into corruption in the private sector.
But that does not mean it's not there, right?
Absolutely, it is there. It is there.
Right. So I want to go now to how do we deal with the situation? How do we get ourselves to press the reset button so that we are able to say that we are a country that is generally not corrupt? Sure, there's no country in the world, I would imagine, that can claim absolute ethics, right? I'm sure there's always something somewhere that is happening. How do we reset? How do we press a reset button that makes us understand that we need ethical leadership?
So I don't think reset is the right approach.
Yeah,
I would say that we are in a rubble, and this rubble is basically like the concept of there are rotten potatoes in the bag of potatoes, right, that we have. And we're not trying to not take out all the potatoes and put in new ones. Yeah. And that would be the
rot everything, yeah.
Yeah, so right now we want to now find a way to get those rotten potatoes out of the bag. And we would need to firstly strengthen our system. So we would need to make sure that in terms of our tracking systems of finances, we need to make sure that just all those things are in place. The recruitment processes are strengthened. We have a lot of independent, institutions coming on board doing the checks and balances. We need to have all of that stuff in place. But at the same time, I think we downplay the role that AI and technology could actually have in tracking some of these loopholes. I think we need to find a way to incorporate technology and AI in Treasury and SARS in the movement of finances across local government, provincial government, national government, what the approval systems look like, the procurement processes also look like. And right now, I'm not even sure if we understand what the gaps and the loopholes are. But I think also then another part is then the governance piece and the public participation part when it comes to the voting. That is going to be extremely crucial. People would need to really, see the vote. And because in voting, there's also then accountability. You need a bit more public accountability and calls for transparency from the public, because internally it's not going to happen. From a whistleblower perspective, people's lives are in danger. But when there's public pressure and there's public scrutiny, then things tend to happen. As to whether those things are effective or not is another question. I mean, the Zondo Commission came as a result of public pressure. It wasn't just because, they wanted to create, but there was a lot of scrutiny around state capture. There was a lot of public complaints and public outrage around it, and that had to happen. As to whether it was effective, that's another question. And I think we need to then scrutinize the political party electoral processes, because that is where a lot of the leaders are then elected. So who are you choosing to be on your candidate list? Who are you choosing to represent South Africans? And members are the ones that are voting. Members of political parties are the ones that are voting. I hope that have enough influence to change the dynamics of who they are electing on their party list. But, yeah, that's another political...
I hear... the AI, I hear systems, I hear political party political electoral reform. I hear all of that. When do we talk about individual moral rectitude?
Yeah, that one is going to be very difficult. I think that one is extremely difficult because I think we then question at what point do we instill that in people? Because one could say, let's start with the education, you know, in our education system, and make sure that we really hone in ethical leadership and those sort of, you know, the African leadership, Ubuntu, those good conceptions. But at what point then do those sort of conceptions change because of an unethical system that forces you to align? So, but I do think some form of education, some form of moral compass value system needs to be embedded. As to how, I think that is the big question. Whether it's at the household level, whether it is in educational systems, whether it's before you enter into public office or whichever power position, we make you go through an entire educational program around value systems.
The reason why I ask about that is because whatever systems we have in place, whatever AI we have in place, whatever change to the electoral system we have, whatever punitive measures for any criminality and corruption we have, if they are not on the basis of some sort of ethical standard, all we're going to do is just make our criminality and corruption that much more sophisticated. I wonder whether there should in fact be a serious conversation about how do we inculcate in society those values which, with the augmentation, with the addition of systems, AI, consequence management, proper electoral systems in place, that those things will support an ethical society. But if the society itself is fundamentally unethical, I'm almost willing to bet, Karabo, that all that will happen is that those systems will aid and abet that unethical reality.
I agree. I think just what makes South Africa so complex is, I think, the diversity and what is regarded then as a value system for me versus what is a value system for you. I think there are assumptions that we could agree on value systems, but it's arguable that it may not be the case. But I agree with you. I do believe that has to be the foundation, and it is the most fundamental thing on top of the other support stuff that is required.
Karabo Mokgwanyana, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Karabo Mokgwanyana is an award-winning legal development practitioner, and we've been talking about the issue of corruption, corrupt leaders.